From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday. It's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. And our panel today includes Ian Mack Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Rachel Cohen, South Central Idaho reporter for Boise State Public Radio, and Julie Lucchetta with Boise State Public Radio News, who is joining us for this first segment. And I do want to get right in to the really big story of the week, and that is the fact that three people died, nine others were injured, five of them critically, after a privately owned hangar under construction near the Boise Airport collapsed on Wednesday. Now, today, the Ada County Coroner's Office did identify the three people killed, saying that they died in the collapse. And BoiseDev.com is reporting the company building the hangar, Big D Builders, does have a history of workplace safety violations from OSHA. Tim Keene is the head of Boise's Planning and Zoning Services, and he says the city did inspect the building that collapsed.
Like we would on any building in the city, we permitted that building and have done inspections of it. We did inspections of the building from October through December of last year on the footings and the foundation, and have never found any issues at all with construction that we've inspected. So we wouldn't really be back out there until they were finished with what they were working on related to the framing and that kind of stuff. We would inspect after that. So we've had no issues with that building through the permitting and inspection process. It's just a tragedy what's happened for the families and everyone involved. So our role at this point is we don't have a role right now because our part of it, we didn't get to our part of it really, which would have been inspection of the completed work.
The city of Boise is now directing all questions to OSHA since that agency has taken over and it is leading the investigation into this collapse. So, Julie, I know we have very scarce details, but what do we know, if anything, at this point about the three men who did lose their lives?
Hi, Gemma. So we have a few details and we're going to hold off on releasing their names until we know more. Right now, we do know that the three men who passed away, one of them was a 59-year-old from Boise, one was a 32-year-old from Nampa, and another one was, the last one was 24 years old from Nampa as well. They were pronounced dead on scene by the Ada County coroner, and that is about it so far.
Okay. Now, Julie, I mentioned at the top of the program that the construction company that's building the hangar has had OSHA violations in the past. There's been lots of headlines over the last day or so about this. However, can you give us some perspective on this? Because I think it's important to put the scope of the violations in perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to contextualize a little bit on this. The company involved, Big D Builders, has had violations, OSHA violations in the past, and I think a lot of headlines in the last few days focused on them specifically. And I just urge listeners to be cautious in jumping to the conclusion that past violations somehow correlate to what happened on Wednesday. The violations in question from the last few years were cited as serious, so I do not want to minimize them. Anything that can result in any kind of serious injury or fatality at a job site is important to check out on. But I do think those violations were around lack of guardrails next to staircases or lack of netting, safety netting to pick up on debris that might fall on workers. So they were fined several thousands of dollars for them, but they happened in the last decade. And I just want to make sure that they are not correlated specifically to the very, very large scale catastrophic event that happened on Wednesday. We currently do not know if what happened on Wednesday, basically we don't know much, right? We do not know if what happened on Wednesday was the result of an OSHA violation to begin with. I went to the site yesterday, and I think when people hear hangar collapse, it's a little abstract, but it is a huge, huge site. And I'll describe it a little bit for folks who might wonder what it looks like. It is a giant steel infrastructure. So don't imagine walls or flooring or anything like that, mostly the backbone of a hangar, and it is completely crumpled in the middle. So a very different problem than what might have happened in the past with like previous OSHA violations from this company.
Right. And Julie, I think it's also fair to say that, as you've said, we don't know a lot about this yet. So even though this company has had those OSHA violations, at this point, we don't know who or what is responsible for the collapse. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes, absolutely. And when things like this happen, I think it's very natural for folks to want answers and want them as soon as possible. And unfortunately, I think we are going to have to be patient about this because of the scale of the event. It's going to take a really long time for folks to kind of decipher exactly what happened. So I know there's going to be a lot of speculation. But I think we need to be cautious in what we assume and don't assume. I spoke to the director of the local office of OSHA yesterday, David Kearns, who obviously they're not going to release any information until they have it, and he did not speculate on anything, and he did mention that this was going to be a fairly complex investigation on their end. And so we are going to have to be patient until we get any kind of information.
Scott, I want to bring you into the conversation as well, because your editorial board wrote a piece on really the importance of this being thoroughly investigated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a tragic and catastrophic event. We were trying to think of the last serious fatal workplace incident like this. And the only thing I could remember was the trench collapse in 2016. Some listeners may remember that. Two people were killed and one was seriously injured. But we've got three dead family members and nine other people are injured, five critically. And not to Julie's point, not to rush this investigation, but to make sure that no stone is left unturned. The crane company, Inland Crane of Boise, they released a statement saying that the building collapsed first, and that snapped the hydraulic arm of the crane. And so I know a lot of people have been speculating, oh, there must have been something wrong with the crane. Was it high winds? There's a lot of speculation about the cost, or the cause, I'm sorry. And it'll take a long time. As Julie said, David Kearns from OSHA said that this is a really complex investigation, with a lot to look at and figure out what happened here. But for the sake of the families and the workers who are still injured, and for future workers to make sure what happened, what went wrong, how did this happen, and make sure that nothing like this happens again.
And
And Julie, oh, go ahead.
sorry, I'll just jump in by saying that David Kearns shared that there's a 6 months period for OSHA to complete an investigation and to penalize or bring up violations when there is a workplace incident. So they do have a timeline to complete their investigation. And they try to meet it. But he did mention that collecting the physical evidence on a site that has so much debris that is probably still dangerous, that would require a lot of effort to dig through, literally interviewing all the people involved and going through all the paperwork is going to take more than a few days, obviously. And I tried to get out of him, maybe a timeline. And he wouldn't commit to one, obviously, because they still don't know the scale of this exactly. And he said probably no information is going to come out for a few months. So that's where we're at.
And Julie, really quickly, I know in your conversation with David Kearns, what did he say in regards also, though, to events like this in particular when we're talking about steel framing?
Right. So construction sites and construction sites that involve steel framing are in the top 10 list of most fatal and dangerous workplaces in the US, which makes sense because unlike a regular, I mean, obviously working in an office is less dangerous than working on a construction site, but working in a factory has very standard practices. Well, a construction site will have every day something new happens. It's like an ever-evolving process. And for steel framework specifically, those are usually used in large-scale construction sites for big buildings. And so there's more risks of falling, there's more risk, technical risk of things happening. So when catastrophic failures happen on job sites and construction sites and on steel framework sites, they're usually more fatal than others, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the updates on this. So a lot to get to in the legislature. And Ian, I want to begin with the Idaho legislature passing a bill earlier this week that would allow for concealed carry of guns in schools. Can you explain this?
Yeah, so this is a bill that would allow basically any teacher or school employee in the state of Idaho at a public school to carry a concealed weapon if they have what's known as an enhanced concealed weapons permit. And people may be curious what that permit is. Essentially, you have to be 21 years or older. You have to have taken an 8-hour gun safety course and submit to a background check. And if a teacher were interested in carrying one of these weapons, if this bill were to become law, they would have to notify their principal and local law enforcement, but would not necessarily have to notify the school board or parents or their students.
Oh, okay. And so, Ian, so what happens next with this bill since it did, it part of it did pass, correct?
Yes, so it passed the House after quite a lot of debate earlier this week. And I think one thing that was interesting about the debate is that a lot of lawmakers, even quite conservative lawmakers, had concerns about the bill. For instance, under state law, there's already policy that allows local school boards to develop their own local gun policies that they and can allow teachers to carry weapons. But under this law, if it were to, or this bill rather, if it were to become law, some lawmakers said they thought they were worried this would undercut school districts that have already taken advantage of that existing law and are already allowing teachers to carry firearms, because it would basically undercut existing safety policies that some school boards have. For instance, some that allow teachers to carry guns have more robust training requirements in order for them to carry firearms, and this would be less restrictive, I guess, than those policies might be. And other lawmakers have, especially in the Boise area, had concerns just about some parents and teachers and others not wanting guns in schools, and being worried that this would essentially force them, teachers. Force allow teachers to carry them, and so basically force a local school district to allow guns in their schools if it were to pass. So it's passed the House already. Now it goes to the Senate, and we'll see what happens there.
Okay. And Scott, your editorial board flat out says this is just a bad idea.
Yeah, there were just a ton of objections to it during the committee hearing. The Idaho Association of School Resource Officers, these are the police officers who are charged with protecting the schools. They oppose the bill. The Boise School District opposed the bill. There were several citizens and former teachers, the Idaho PTA, the state's teachers union, and many school boards oppose the bill for a lot of good reasons, maybe some specious arguments. But one of the things that I heard loud and clear was one of the legislators from Twin Falls. He said that he talked to his superintendent of his school district out there, and he said that their insurance policy is going to get canceled right away once this passes because there's such a liability of having guns in schools. I don't know if that was really addressed or taken into consideration. The I don't want to say collateral damage, but the unintended consequences of this bill. There were just a lot of points of opposition that were brought up that I think weren't really addressed or considered before they passed it.
And Scott, my understanding too is that students were not allowed to testify. Is that accurate?
It is. There were, it's interesting because the testimony, this was in the State Affairs Committee, chaired by Representative Brent Crane. And he has kind of a reputation for picking and choosing which folks can testify before the committee. And the last word was from the state representative of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, had the last word at the committee hearing. And I didn't really think anything of it, but then we found out that there were several students who signed up to testify and just were never given an opportunity to testify. They cut off the testimony at 10:30 or 11 o'clock or whatever the time was. And so we reached out to those students and we invited them to write letters to the editor and let us know, let our readers know what their objections were and let them say what they weren't allowed to say at the committee hearing.
And I know you've got that on your website if folks are interested in reading those. So, Scott, I want to stick with education for a little bit longer. Talk to us about this proposed tax credit for families who want to send their children to private schools. You wrote a very compelling argument about this in regards to this in one particular gentleman who spoke about his Hill situation.
Yeah, Robbie Hart lives in Emmett. He's a single dad. He has two sons, and he wants to send his kids. He sends his two sons to Greenleaf Academy, and he chooses not to send his sons to the schools in the Emmett School District. And he drives 62 miles to Greenleaf Academy and then 72 miles back home from his from the Boise Bible College where he's a student. And he talked at a press conference a couple of weeks ago as a precursor to this bill. And the bill actually got proposed, introduced this week in the House. And it is a $5,000 tax credit for folks to offset any expenses they have for a non-public education. I don't think it's gotten a hearing yet, but it's just been printed. And Ian can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
That's correct.
And so, but
Okay, so
I'm sure this will get a hearing pretty soon. There's also a grant portion of this, a $10 million grant portion that gives a direct grant, $5,000 grant to parents who want to send a child to a private school or homeschool or other education desires. And again, this is similar. It's kind of a different take of the school voucher program, but it's essentially the same thing. It releases tax liability from people who want to send their kids to a non-public education. And there are tons of arguments against it that, the usual ones about siphoning money from the public school system, the potential for abuse and fraud, the lack of accountability, the credits benefiting mostly the well-off and the wealthy. But I think there's also, an argument about the kind of puts the choice argument on its head. The argument is that the money should follow the students and the parents are the best ones to choose for their students, for their children. But what if their argument is that they simply don't like their public school, which is provided by taxpayers, because they want their children to pray in school? So under this bill, we would, as taxpayers, be required to pay for that choice. What if they don't like their public school because that school teaches evolution? And so now they want to pull their students out of public education, which I know taxpayers pay for, and send their child to a school that teaches that evolution is wrong. So I think there's a lot of debate that still needs to be had with this bill. I'm hopeful that there is a full hearing, that people are heard and get full testimony when this bill comes forward. And I suspect that that will be pretty soon because I know that this is a priority for a lot of legislators, and we'll probably see a quick hearing on it.
So, Scott, can you clarify something with this bill? So it's this $500 tax credit. Now, as you mentioned, $5,000 per student. And so it's, but there's $10 million. So does that mean it's first come, first serve? And the reason why I ask this is this gentleman that that spoke, I mean, he is not well off, right? He is making sacrifice after sacrifice.
Right.
He is going to have to then go up against, you know, people like you and I, Scott. Let's be transparent. Our kids have gone through private school. It is a choice that we have made. So is that how this would work, or is it for any child whose parents wants to send to use that money outside of public education?
Right. And just to clarify, the grant portion is only $10 million. The tax rebate is up to $40 million. So it's a total of $50 million. And it is. It's first come, first served. There are no income requirements on this. And I asked Representative Wendy Horman and Senator Lori Den Hartog, the two sponsors of the bill, about this. And Den Hartog, you know, she kind of bristled when I asked the question, and she said that, you know, it's a misnomer or misperception that only the wealthy send their kids to private school. You know, I would kind of push back on that. I understand that there are people like
Robin Hartman back a little bit on that.
Who are not wealthy. And so if you really do want to help folks who are lower income to make that choice, then why not put income targets on it or income limits on it? And I guess for me, I would be much more amenable to something like that if it were targeted. And the state has done this, the Empowering Parents Grants. I don't know if you recall this, but this was during COVID, where people were homeschooling their kids, and this is during the pandemic. And the state did put income limits on it, up to $50,000 median household income. And it worked. Almost all of the grants, the Empowering Parents Grants, went to folks who had a median income, median household income of $50,000 or less. And then they opened it up when those were all used up to $75,000. And again, they filled that up. And so it is possible to target this, but you know, it's going to be folks who are already sending their kids to private school, and it's going to be a dog eat dog, first come, first serve situation for these grants and the rebates.
And I would agree with you, Scott. I think it would be a lot more, and many a lot more people would be okay with something like this if, as you just laid out, there were income limits on something like that. But we will see what happens with this. I definitely do not think this is the last we hear of this. I want to head outside of the legislature for a minute, because Rachel, some breaking news literally just came in before the program today in regards to gray wolves and their endangered species listing.
Yeah. So today, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that it will not relist gray wolves in the Rocky Mountains under the Endangered Species Act. And so that means that wolves in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and parts of Eastern Oregon and Washington will remain under state control. And conservation groups filed this petition to list wolves in these states in 2021. That request was made in part because of recent changes in laws in states like Idaho that greatly expanded opportunities for hunting and trapping wolves. But today, the Fish and Wildlife Service says it used robust modeling, and it looked at the latest science, and it said that its models also included threats like human-caused mortality to wolves, and it determined that wolves are, quote, not at risk of extinction in the Western United States now or in the foreseeable future.
And that literally just came down today.
Yeah. And, you know, in Idaho a couple years ago, Idaho Fish and Game said there were about 1,500 wolves in the state. Last year, it estimated the population had dropped to more like 1,300. And in this announcement, you know, it is brand new, and we haven't really had a chance to look it over in detail. But one interesting part of it is that the Fish and Wildlife Service says that it will develop a first of its kind national recovery plan for wolves. You know, wolves are already, you know, have endangered species protections in most other states outside of this region. But the reason why that announcement of the recovery plan is interesting is that That usually accompanies when species are given protections under the Endangered Species Act. And then that plan kind of outlines, you know, conservation actions to help the species recover. But in this case, you know, the wolves were not given or did not receive federal protections, and yet the agency announced that there will be a recovery plan. And so it will be interesting to see what that actually entails, given that wolves in these states, including Idaho, will remain under state jurisdiction.
So, Ian, talk to us about Governor Little coming out and saying that he's going to be sending, is it troops to the Mexico border?
He'll be sending troopers with the Idaho State Police to the, the border as part of an effort to secure the border and keep migrants from crossing the border. And this is something we've seen him do in the past. In 2021, he did something similar. And yeah, it's part of a kind of escalating confrontation, I would say, at the border between conservative governors of conservative states and the federal government over what we've seen in the last few months, which is a rising number of migrants crossing the border. And so Governor Little plans to send state police to the border, and he also himself plans to visit the border in sort of solidarity and association with the governor of Texas and other governors who are concerned that the federal government they think is not enforcing border security enough. And so this is kind of an ongoing confrontation over the last few days.
Okay. So Scott, can you add a little bit more context to this in particular about, I mean, here got the Governor Little is going to go down kind of in support, as Ian said, of Texas's Governor Greg Abbott. What is this dispute exactly that's been going on between Texas and the federal government?
Well, I think there can be no argument that we have a problem at the border and that we've got to solve it. What's been happening in Texas, just as background, the state of Texas has been putting up razor wire along the border, which has been shown. There's evidence that people are getting injured and some seriously because of the razor wire. Federal Border Patrol agents have been removing some of the razor wire. Number one, because it is considered inhumane and is injuring people. And then secondly, the federal government, the Border Patrol agents are saying that it's preventing them, it's impeding them from doing their jobs, that it's preventing them access to areas that they need in order to capture migrants who are crossing the border illegally. So they've been removing some of that razor wire. And what happened is that the state of Texas sued the federal government to stop doing that. And a federal judge, a federal court said, no, the federal government can remove that. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yes, the federal government, the border agents can continue removing that razor wire. Well, in the meantime, the state of Texas continued to put up razor wire. And so it was mischaracterized as a defiance of the Supreme Court. They weren't really defying the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did not say you cannot put up razor wire. They just said that the federal government could continue to put up or to take down the razor wire. And really, it's just turned into, like Ian said, it's just a simmering confrontation. It's been classified as a showdown, and it's being used to score political points. We also found out at the same time that there was a deal to work on the border. And former President Donald Trump was pressuring Senate Republicans to not go along with negotiations on that border deal because they did not want to give President Joe Biden a victory on this issue, and wanted to let it simmer until the election so that Donald Trump could use it as an election issue. And so a number of Republican governors, Brad Little included, all across the country, about 26 of them, have jumped on board and turned this into a really just political theater. And rather than coming up with a solution and trying to come up with some sort of solution for the border, they are turning this whole thing into a into political theater, really.
Rachel, earlier this month, well, not this month, last month, since the day is now February, the annual sled dog race in McCall was canceled. There wasn't enough snow, so they had to cancel it. But You just recently reported on the fact that there are some kind, really some big impacts to that cancellation.
Yeah, there are definitely there are big impacts within the mushing community, which is fairly small. But so the there's the big sled dog race in Alaska in early March called the Iditarod, and it's considered like the Mount Everest of sled dog races. And to qualify for that is kind of a process. You need to have raced a couple 300-mile sled dog competitions, and they need to be, you know, official approved competitions, and then a 150-mile one as well. And the Idaho Sled Dog Challenge in McCall, it was one of three approved 300-mile races in the lower 48 states. And so for some people, they had been looking to these races, and I should note, actually all three of them, not just the one in McCall, all three of them were canceled this month, last month, January. Mm-hmm. And so the collective cancellation of those races did have some impacts, both for mushers who were trying to use them to qualify for the Iditarod in future years, and for people going to Alaska this year, because they use these races to train, even to evaluate their dogs and maybe see like who they're gonna take, and so yeah, there definitely were some impacts beyond Idaho from this cancellation.
And then, Rachel, I read this headline recently and found this fascinating. And this is about cloud seeding. So talk to us about what you found out about some new technology.
Yeah, so I recently reported a story about cloud seeding in Idaho, and specifically one development that's happening here. And that is Idaho Power, which is kind of the main entity that does most of the cloud seeding here in Idaho, which is essentially releasing particles into the sky to encourage clouds that already hold moisture to produce more precipitation. And in the winter, we hope that that is snow. And so the new development is that Idaho Power is starting to use a different seeding agent, a gas called liquid propane, which is the same propane that you might use for grilling. They are using that now to cloud seed. And that's unique because across the West, where cloud seeding happens, scientists mostly use this one compound called silver iodide, and it's just been used for decades. And it's proven pretty trustworthy. But the reason why Idaho Power is trying liquid propane now is that it can actually seed clouds in warmer temperatures. It's not drastically warmer. It's about 7 degrees warmer than silver iodide. So this doesn't mean that we're going to start cloud seeding here year round. That's not going to happen. But they still think that it could open up new opportunities to cloud seed in Idaho, whether that's, you know, extending the season by like a week or two on either end, or perhaps doing it in different regions of the state. And this is, you know, one thing I found interesting is that the National Center for Atmospheric Research is also getting involved, and they're also curious about liquid propane. So they're doing a study with the state of Idaho here as well to better understand it. You know, it's not a brand new technology, but it was essentially like disregarded a while ago because silver iodide was the one that people chose.
So at this point, Rachel, are they using this new technology right now?
Yes. Idaho Power has 6 liquid propane generators in the Payette River Basin. And they are located pretty close to silver iodide generators that they already had. And so they're using those right now this winter. And, you know, one example is that Idaho Power scientists said that when storms roll in, the very front end of a storm, the temperatures are also often warmer and sometimes too warm to use silver iodide. So they are thinking like maybe they are turning on the liquid propane generator like a day or hours before they turn on the silver iodide generators. And even just that could theoretically help them produce more snowfall. Although, you know, the one reason why the national research is happening here is that there's still a lot that we don't know about this liquid propane cloud seeding. Like the most basic question, how well it works.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate the update, and I want to thank all of you for joining us today. We've been talking with Ian Mac Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, our very own Rachel Cohen, who is the South Central Idaho reporter for Boise State Public Radio News, and Julie Lucchetta with Boise State Public Radio News, who joined us for the first segment. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.